So mark your calendars and help us spread the word to student filmmakers. For more information, go to our website, studentcam.org.
Next, a classroom discussion on the Indian Claims Commission, which was a judicial panel created in 1946 for relations between the U.S. government and Native American tribes. The commission was established by Congress to hear claims of Indian tribes against the United States and was meant to resolve many longstanding issues. Held at the University of Utah, this is an hour and 20 minutes.
All right, so I guess we should go ahead and get started. It's quarter of. Quick announcement, just so you're aware of where we're at in the schedule. Tuesday of next week, we will have the final quiz. I'm sure you're happy about that for this class. And that is on Laurie Arnold's book, so please be ready for that at the beginning of class. Now, today what I want to do is talk about the Indian Claims Commission as a means of continuing our discussion of tribal sovereignty in the 20th century, specifically the mid-20th century. The Indian Claims Commission is something that often is not, people don't spend a whole lot of time on, but I think it's very important, I think for a couple of reasons. It certainly points out the link between resources and land, control of resources and land, and tribal sovereignty. It also illustrates very clearly the limitations on tribal sovereignty that the federal government puts in place. Legislation that might seem to empower Indian people at times also has real limitations on it. And then we're going to spend a lot of time today talking about one particular claim, the Western Shoshone claim, one of the most controversial of all, one that lasted over half a century. And that claim in particular illustrates how Native conceptions of political power and control of territory, ownership of property, are fundamentally different from European and Euro-American legal conceptions. And that poses real obstacles to tribal sovereignty, certainly in regard to the land claims process. So what I want to do at first is start with some background information, talk about the Indian Claims Commission in general and the claims process, and give you an idea of how that worked, and then move into a much more in-depth look at the one particular claim for the Western Shoshone people. So let's go ahead. Now, the Indian Claims Commission is going to be signed into law in 1946, but it is not the first time Indian peoples had made claims against the United States. Indian claims were first heard way back in 1831 by the United States Supreme Court, right? And other mechanisms existed in the United States for claims against the government. Tribes are not the only groups seeking redress from the government. Individual citizens did, right? And for individual citizens before 1855, claims followed a particular process, individual acts of Congress. Now, before I talk about those private bills, one thing you need to keep in mind is this idea of sovereign immunity, the doctrine of sovereign immunity. The United States and other sovereigns subscribe to this legal doctrine, and just to boil it down to a simple phrase, you don't get to sue the sovereign unless the sovereign says you do, right? You cannot sue the United States unless the United States give you permission to sue it, right? So that's the basis for all of this, the doctrine of sovereign immunity. Now, before 1855, individual citizens who had a claim against the government over a contract, over a perceived wrong, whatever, could seek redress, but they did it directly through Congress. They got a congressman to introduce a bill, these so-called private bills. And you see these things filling the congressional record. And there's a lot of them out there. And it's for that reason, in 1855, that Congress created the Court of Claims. Right? The Court of Claims was envisioned to deal with all of these claims and to relieve that burden from Congress. At first, the court is simply an advisory board, in a sense. It can only tell Congress what should happen. Right? But in 1863, Second piece of legislation gave the Court of Claims the power to make final determinations, final decisions. And for much of its history, during especially these Indian claims, the Court of Claims sat in that building, which is directly across from the White House and the old Executive Office Building, and is today the Smithsonian's Renwick Gallery. So you might have seen it when you visited Washington. Okay. Now, native access to the court. You might imagine immediately native tribes said, well, this might be the avenue to pursue claims against the government for wrongs, for the loss of our land. And some tried. But that piece of legislation I mentioned in 1863 that gave the court the power to make final determinations also barred tribes. It stated that the court could hear no claims, quote, growing out of or dependent upon any treaty stipulation entered into with foreign nations or with Indian tribes. So Indians are excluded, just like that. Okay. And that's the way it remains for some time. The shift starts to occur during the assimilation era that we spent so much time talking about. And one of the most important moments comes with the case of Standing Bear v. Crook. And we talked about Standing Bear before. His case and the case of his people, the Ponca, and their hope to remain in their homeland becomes a celebrity cause among the reformers, right? The test case, Standing Bear v. Crook, is also important, though, in terms of claims, because this case, even though it decides that Indians are not citizens of the United States, they are deemed to be persons with particular protections under the law, right? At the same time, these reformers, remember, are all arguing that Indians need to be made subject to United States law. We need to set aside traditional forms of government and justice and replace them with these more civilized forms. It made very little sense to these reformers, then, that Indians should be barred from using a legal system, right? The civilized Euro-American legal system. And so in 1881, Congress for the first time granted a tribe, in this case the Choctaws, the right to bring a case before the Court of Claims. And that's the way it would remain for the next 65 years, up to 1946. Each individual suit or claim brought before the court by native peoples had to have a special piece of enabling legislation to make that happen. Now, once you got there, it's tough to get there, and once you get there, your chances of winning during this period are not good at all, right? Of the 134 cases heard by the Court of Claims during this period, Native peoples only won 28. The Choctaws did win that first claim. The cases are often dismissed by the court on very narrow technical grounds, mostly grounds that relate to the enabling legislation itself. To give you an example from the 1942 case, Northwestern Band Shoshone's claims case, the Court of Claims threw that one out because it said, well, in the enabling legislation, it said that they could be compensated for lands that were held by treaty. But they didn't really hold them by treaty. They had them before that, so it was by aboriginal title. Therefore, the case is gone. Right? So there's all of these kinds of technicalities that cases get thrown out. Once you win a case, if you're one of those 28 groups that does win a case, your cash that you get from the government is severely reduced by what are called offsets. Offsets are so-called gratuitous expenditures of the government. And what that means is it is an expense that the government made on behalf of these people on an individual group that is not stipulated in a treaty. What are some of those costs? Well, if you were removed from your homeland and forced to go somewhere else, that could be a gratuity. So you end up paying the cost of your own removal, right? And so of these cases, the cash awards are reduced by an average of 60%. 60%. In some cases, it's really egregious. The Blackfeet case was a reduction of 90%, from over $6 million to $622,000. The offsets reduce the actual cash that the Blackfeet get, right? And so this is the situation Native peoples are in. Now, in fact, the number of cases increases radically in the 1920s. This is in part related to Native service in World War I, and good feelings about Native peoples in America. You know, in 1920, Native veterans become citizens. 1924, the Indian Citizenship Act makes all Indian citizens of the United States. And there are a flurry of enabling acts in Congress. Between 1924 and 1927, a three-year period, 38 claims were filed. And that's about the same number had been filed since 1881, right? So there's a flurry of claims. And what this leads to are calls for a special commission, a special Indian Claims Commission to handle these claims, right? The idea actually goes back to 1910 in the Commission of Indian Affairs, but it's in the 1920s that more and more people call for this, and it's also part of the Merriam Report, which we talked about, I think, last time, the special report on Indian administration that the government commissioned in the late 1920s. Okay, so that's the background of Indian claims before the commission. Where does the commission come from? Or any questions on that before I move on? Okay. Where does the commission come from? Well, the immediate origin of the Indian Claims Commission should be understood in this previous claims history, but also in the fluctuations in federal policy in the 20th century. As you all know, the 1930s sees a major shift in policy, the Indian New Deal, the end of assimilation policy, the end of allotment, right? And this is when Congress will hold numerous hearings on Indian claims and on the idea of an independent commission. Four times between 1930 and 1940, Congress holds special hearings on an Indian Claims Commission. Right. Now, the Claims Commission was something that John Collier considered for the Indian Reorganization Act, but he rejected it because he thought it would overburden the act, which was already a complicated act. And claims were somewhat controversial. One of the key sponsors of the Indian Reorganization Act was Burton K. Wheeler, right? His name's attached to it. It's called the Wheeler-Howard Act. The Indian Reorganization Act, the Wheeler-Howard Act. Burton K. Wheeler was very suspicious of claims attorneys and vocally expressed his belief that it was really claims attorneys driving this process, seeking their cut, essentially. So Collier's not going to include it in the Indian Reorganization Act. The shift comes post-World War II and post-Collier. In 1945 and 1946, Congress holds a final set of hearings on the Indian Claims Commission idea. One of the key witnesses is this man, Ernest Wilkinson, a claims attorney. He was born in Ogden, but he was the chief partner in a very powerful Washington, D.C.-based law firm that dealt mostly in Indian law and specifically in Indian claims, right? He testified in 1945 before these hearings. He railed against the narrow decisions of the Court of Claims, specifically that of the Northwestern Band Shoshones, which he was one of the attorneys on that case. He testified that he had lost, he'd spent 7 years and $12,000 of his own money that he had lost, basically. So he is going to argue for a claims commission that is empowered to make final decisions. He also suggests that lawyers' fees should be bumped up from 10 to 15%. That's not going to happen. It remains at a maximum of 10%, right? And the final act, the Indian Claims Commission Act, will come out of that set of hearings. And in 1946, August of 1946, it will be passed by Congress and signed into law by Harry Truman. Okay, so what's in the act, you might ask? Right, the Indian Claims Commission Act allowed tribes or any identifiable group, right? It says any Indian tribe, band, or other identifiable group of American Indians residing within the territorial limits of the United States or Alaska to bring a claim before this commission, right? It created a three-person commission. In practice, that commission acted more like a court. And what I mean by that is it had adversarial proceedings, right? So tribes hired counsels. They hired attorneys. No tribe pursued a claim on its own. Right? Claims attorneys are always involved. They also hired expert witnesses. Right? The Act set up a very tight time frame, which didn't work out the way they thought it would. The filing part of it did. Tribes had 5 years to file claims, right? So the deadline for filing a claim before the commission was August 13th, 1951. Then, theoretically, all of these claims cases would be decided in the next 5 years. So the Indian Claims Commission is only supposed to last from 1946 to 1956. Of course, that's not the way it works out. It lasts until 1978. Right, so that is, you know, a long period there, 1978. By that time, it heard 370 dockets divided into 617 sub-dockets and decided 550 of them. At that point, what was left over went back to the Court of Claims. Right? Now, this bill is going to receive bipartisan support in Congress. It can be conceived of by those who are pro-Indian and pro-sovereignty as justice, right? Paying off a debt long owed. This is justice. But it's also viewed by more conservative forces, people who want to see a return to an assimilation policy, that say that they view it as, well, thinking the same way, well, we finally paid them off. Now we can end the federal government's relationship with tribes. So for some, this premises the termination policy that follows very, very closely after it. It's not explicitly part of termination, but it certainly plays into it, the idea of paying off the debt so now we can move on. Right. Does that make sense? So it gets support from both sides in these debates. Okay. I know this is pretty, as always, technical stuff. Yes.
So who served on the commission?
Individuals who are appointed by the President of the United States, by the executive branch, and they're the various people over the years. So it's not a stable commission.
Okay.
There's a lot rosters, probably 20 or 30 different people over the course of the commission that served on it. But three at a time. Right? And they often are attorneys or government officials. Right? Okay. The process. Let's talk about the general process here and how it is, in a couple of very, very important ways, antithetical to native understandings of political authority and property ownership. Right? For some native people, they welcome the claims process. Right? It's an inflow of cash. For others, though, it seems, again, to be a violation of their way of life. Every claim is going to go through three phases: title, value liability, and then the offsets. All right? I'm not going to spend any time really talking about the offsets here. Under the Indian Claims Commission Act, the offsets were not completely defined, but much better defined than the earlier claims cases. A whole range of expenses by the government were excluded. They couldn't be counted. Like, you couldn't count the cost of removing somebody in these offsets. And so the offsets are far, far lower, right? On average, only about 2%. In some cases, more, right? But on average, only about 2%. So we're not going to spend too much time talking about that. What I want to focus on are these first two, title and value liability, and always bring it back to this point. This is not one of the phases, but this is one of the crucial factors of the operation of the Claims Commission. No land would be returned. This is not about acknowledging native title or returning land to native people. It is about a monetary settlement, right? And that's going to shape the entire process. The first phase that any tribe is going to have to enter into is the title phase. So once the claim is filed, the docket or the case goes to the title phase. In this phase, the tribe is burdened with proving what is called exclusive use and occupancy from time immemorial to a definable area. Right? Now, this is not a native concept. Native people did have distinct ideas about property, about the land, and about who could possess the land as a group. But the idea of exclusive use and occupancy was not a common idea. This is a European and Euro-American legal idea, right? It's really related to abstract property ownership, right? So they have to prove this. Now, at times, the commission did recognize native definitions were of exclusive use varied, but in general, it's going to come down to exclusive use and occupancy. This poses a serious obstacle to tribes. Attorneys are going to employ expert witnesses, and they employ ethno-historical methods. That's why I have a picture of the journal Ethnohistory up there. That society emerges from this period. Ethnohistory is a discipline, a combination of anthropology and history, using culture, using an understanding of another people's culture to interpret historical documents emerges directly from the work of the Indian Claims Commission as anthropologists and historians work together to prove native claims. Right? But unfortunately, the problem with title, of course, is that there's a real conflict of interest here. The fact that exclusive use and occupancy wasn't a native term meant that claims attorneys had no incentive to go after or make claims on areas where multiple groups use that area, right? Because they saw that as a losing proposition. Even more importantly, there is absolutely no incentive to claim that native title still exists, because you can only collect the fee when native title is proven, but then also when the claims commission accepts that it is lost, that it is gone, right? Does that make sense? So there's a real conflict of interest here. Now, Indian lands judicially established. This is a famous map. This comes directly from the final report of the Indian Claims Commission in 1978. All of the areas that are not shaded are areas that no claim was certified. Nobody got paid for that land. Did Native people live there? Oh, yes, right? Concrete example, this area around the Boise Valley up here, right? Shoshones, Bannocks, Northern Paiutes, you know, all variously used that area. But the different entities, different political entities involved in these claims cases are steered away from making a claim there because, again, the losing proposition of joint use would prevent a settlement, and attorneys are not going to spend valuable time and money pursuing the claim that they don't think will win. Does that make sense? Okay, then we go into the value liability phase. This is where we determine how much money a tribe gets from the claim settlement, right? Values are going to be determined at what is called fair market value at the time of taking. Not today, right? So if this settlement's made, if the claims commission's hearing this case in 56 or 57, it's not going to go and look for a value in 1956 or 57 prices. It's going to look at the point at which the land was taken. In some cases, in many cases, there's a very definable moment. In the Lakota case I'm going to talk about just briefly in a moment, 1877, the treaty that follows the Great Sioux War of 1876-77 when the Lakotas lose the Black Hills, that's a definable point, and that's when that land is going to be valued, right? What happens after title phase is that the attorneys will hire expert appraisers who go out into the field and they use a range of resources, a range of historical sources, and they make what the Supreme Court in another case called an informed guess. I mean, that's basically what appraisal is, right? An informed guess on how much something is worth. There is no adjustment for lost profits or inflation, and there's no interest. We'll talk about ballooning settlements, and that interest comes after the actual final determination of the Claims Commission, not from the time of taking, right? So we're going to get a very straightforward payment. And again, the emphasis is cash only, no return of land. That is the big rub for so many tribes. That is going to be the sticking point. They want the land back. One of the most famous cases of this, which is still an ongoing case, is that of the Lakota, the Western Sioux people, and the Black Hills. Right? The Black Hills were sacred to the Lakota people. They were made part of the Great Sioux Reservation. We talked about that. You read the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868. That created the Great Sioux Reservation, made up of essentially all of western South Dakota and a chunk of North Dakota as well, right, including the Black Hills. In the wake of the Great Sioux War of 1876-77, an agreement is forced, really, upon the Lakota people, and the Black Hills are gone. And this is, again, something that is very traumatic for Lakota people. In 1972, the Indian Claims Commission decided that the government owed the Lakota tribes $17.5 million for the taking of the land. $17.5 million. Now, of course, that land is some of the most productive gold mines in American history, right, around Deadwood and Leeds, South Dakota. But that doesn't play into it, right? In 1979, the Court of Claims upheld this ruling and added 5% in simple interest. And that brought the final award to the Lakotas to $106 million. So $106 million. The Lakota tribes, in unison, refused to take the money. And up to today, they still refuse to take the money, although there are moves and there are people who say, you know, the land's not coming back. We need to take the settlement due to interest as it sits untouched in the treasury. The Lakota settlement is now over $1 billion that the combined Lakota tribes have not taken. And as you can imagine, that's a lot of money. And that can eat away at people's resolve. It can change a lot of lives. It can change tribal existence, right? So there seems to be, who knows, how long this might last. Or whether the Lakotas will continue to resist taking this settlement. But for now, that's where it sits. Okay, so questions about the general operations of the Indian Claims Commission. Okay. I guess I'm completely clear. All right. So what I want to do for the remainder of our time, you know, for the next 55 minutes or so, is focus on one claim in particular. And I think that in doing this, we can really get at those differences between political understandings and property ownership and the way in which this system is set up that disadvantages certain segments of a Native community and puts control in the hands of others. Right. Now, the Western Shoshone land claim, one of the longest fought battles of all, also one of the more famous. It becomes a celebrity cause as well. Documentary films are made about it in the 1970s and 1990s, and most recently about 2006 that focus on it. Robert Redford narrated the first two of them. So, I mean, it does become a well-known case. Now, the basis of this is the Treaty of Ruby Valley. All right, so we need to talk about the treaty and the Shoshone homeland. Newa Segovia. Right? That's how the Shoshone people would say it. Right? Newa is the Shoshone word for themselves, for the people. And all Shoshones, Paiutes, Bannocks, Utes, all have a word in their language that sounds somewhat similar, which means the people, because they're all linguistically related. For our purpose, though, what I want to focus in on are these entwined concepts in the Native political order about political authority and land ownership, who talks for the people and for whom, and how do you possess a land. Right. Now, there's this, you often hear, Native peoples had no concept of private property. Well, that's just bunk. It's not really true. However, in terms of land as property, ownership of the land really inherited in the people themselves, in a group. Right. All Shoshone peoples, all Newa groups, shared a sense of a larger homeland. Right. This concept of this Western Shoshone homeland. Right. Now, but not all of them lived in one or traveled throughout the whole area. They traveled some long distances, but not everywhere. And so in each case, you have smaller groups that have their own smaller homelands, places where they generally range, right? And for those people, the rights to the resources of the land were unfettered. They could use anything that was there. But they didn't use it at the exclusion of other Shoshone people. They recognized other Shoshone people as kin. Their political leaders, who were known as talkers, right, in the anthropological literature, what they basically do is negotiate access. Right? Because the Great Basin is a pretty harsh place, people move around seasonally. Sometimes harvests of pine nuts or other types of resources are not uniform year to year. And so mobility and sharing are part of the survival strategy, the subsistence strategy. And this doesn't just apply to Shoshone people, it also applies to Paiute people as well, right? And so native leaders negotiated access. Other people came in, and so you negotiate that sharing because you need to go to their land at times as well, right? So there's a sense of this larger shared homeland, but there's also this sense of smaller groups, right? And their own homelands. There is absolutely, positively no head chief. This is what Euro-Americans desperately want, and they try to create in many different ways. They try to recognize individuals they think they can work with as head chiefs. But Shoshone leaders consistently throughout this period, not just in Nevada, but in Idaho and in Wyoming and other places, tell treaty negotiators, I don't speak for everyone. I can't speak for everyone. This is not hidden from the treaty negotiators. And so that gets us to the Treaty of Ruby Valley. I've mentioned this treaty briefly before, and certainly in the context of the so-called Doty treaties. And we're sitting here in Salt Lake City, Utah, and James Duane Doty was superintendent of Indian Affairs for Utah Territory and then governor for a briefer period of Utah Territory. And in the wake of the Bear River Massacre, he negotiated a series of five treaties with Shoshone people. In his letter to the president, to the Secretary of Interior, he described all Shoshone people as really sharing one big chunk of land. But he also understood he had to make all of these different treaties with these groups. Right? So the five treaties, you know, Box Elder, Tooele, Soda Springs, Fort Bridger, and Ruby Valley. This is the map that he sent to the National Archive, or to the Indian Bureau, to Washington, that shows this huge swath of Shoshone territory stretching from Nevada all the way across northern Utah into Wyoming, right? So it's a pretty well-known historic map. Right? Now, Doty is the Utah superintendent of Indian Affairs, so he's in Nevada. Nevada's a territory already. James W. Nye is also there, the governor of Nevada, is also involved in this treaty. And the principal signatory, though, for the Western Shoshones is a leader named Timok. Later, he'll be called Old Timok. You see that in the historic literature as well. Right. So Timok is the principal Shoshone spokesman and is acting as a traditional Shoshone leader. Right. Now, what the treaty does is it provides access to Shoshone country. It does not cede any land. And it provides $5,000 a year for 20 years for the loss of game, an annuity payment. Right. Again, I emphasize there's no land cession specified in this treaty. So let's look at two provisions of it in particular that are the critical ones for understanding this claim. First of all, Article 5. It spells out Western Shoshone territory. And it basically stretches from the Shoshone River Valley or the Snake River Valley, right, south to the area today, which would be Death Valley and Southern California. And from the west, what is today the Desitoya Range out near Fallon, Nevada, over to the Steptoe Valley and the Great Salt Lake Valley, which, of course, have those names today. Those are the current names as well as the historic names of those places. So wide swath of territory. The Indian Claims Commission will eventually, you know, consider this as, you know, 22 million acres or so of land, a huge swath of territory. Now, again, it's not ceded, though. This article is critical. Article 4 of the treaty is the one that made the provisions for white settlement or use of this land. And I'll read it to you. It says, it is further agreed by the parties hereto that the Shoshone country may be explored and prospected for gold and silver or other minerals, and when mines are discovered, they may be worked and mining and agricultural settlements formed and ranches established wherever they may be required. Mills may be erected and timber taken for their use, and also for building and other purposes in any part of the country claimed by said bands. Think about that provision, and think about how a traditional Shoshone leader would interpret that. If negotiating access to resources and this strategy of sharing for survival is your traditional mindset, would you interpret that as giving your land away? Or would you interpret that as in a very traditional context? Right. So the Shoshones do not see this as a treaty of cession. And in fact, it's not. Nowhere in it is the Shoshone territory ceded. And so despite allowing white mining and settlement, there's no cession. And from this point on, the Western Shoshones will not be at war with the United States. So what does that mean? It means that the two principal methods from the colonial period into the 20th century where Indian title is extinguished do not apply in this case. A just war of conquest, remember, how do you determine what's just, right? And a legal cession. In neither case do the Shoshones lose their land for those reasons, which seem to be the only two. So the Indian Claims Commission is going to come up with a very different idea of how and when the Western Shoshones lost their land. Okay, questions so far? Now, what I want to do then is talk about the period between the Treaty of Ruby Valley in 1863 and the Indian Claims Commission in 1946. And again, to go back to what we talked about, the Great Basin and California as well offer a very important counterexample to most people's perception of how the conquest of Native America took place, right, at the hands of the federal government with soldiers and troops. We know that in the Great Basin and California, conquest took place really at the hands of local power interests, right? The federal government stepped out of the way and let it happen, right? Whether it's the Mormon Church in Utah, mining interests, or ranching interests in Nevada, right? It's policy tends to be local. And so reservations are few and far between, right? Reservations in the Great Basin are few and far between, right? On the margins of the Great Basin up here, you have the Fort Hall Reservation, right? Which is really in the Snake River Plains, not in the basin itself. You have the two larger reservations out here, which are Paiute reservations, Pyramid Lake and Walker River, which were established in 1859, right at the time of the Comstock Silver Rush. Right, so right when that's happening, they're getting flooded in. But then you don't get reservations, another reservation for the next 18 years. And the reservation that's going to be founded for Western Shoshones is up here. Right? It's called Duck Valley. Federal officials would view this reservation, founded in 1877, as a place to concentrate all Western Shoshone groups, regardless of where they were from. This idea of consolidation was really popular in the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the late 19th century. The idea is that it would speed assimilation, we get all these people together in one place, and most of all, it would cut costs, right? It'd be more economical than having all of these scattered reservations we have to supply. Right? The groups that lived closest to the area, and some displaced by white settlement farther north and west, did go there. Most were from the Western Shoshone band called the White Knife. Western Shoshones from northern Nevada. So that's their homeland, that's where they go. Most Western Shoshones, though, refused to go. Most Western Shoshones would not go to Duck Valley, and they remained on their homelands, often hundreds of miles away. And as a result, around the turn of the 20th century, over a dozen more small executive order reservations were created in the Great Basin. In many ways, this parallels the creation of those rancherias we talked about in California. Small groups of Native people who refused to leave where they had always lived. And the federal government, coming very late to the game, will establish these reservations. Right? And the reservations we're talking about include Fort McDermott in 1892, Fallon in 1902. Both are shared with the Northern Paiutes. Within the Western Shoshone territory itself, the Yamba Reservation in 1937, Duckwater in 1940, and South Fork in 1941. Right? So those are within the Western Shoshone Territory. Now, there are other types of land ownership or land tenure that Western Shoshone people follow at this time. One of the most important are the so-called Indian colonies. Kind of ironic, right? Indians are colonizing when this is really a product. Indian colonies are a product of colonization, of colonialism, right? But Indians are establishing these colonies, right? They are established in many towns in Nevada. The idea of an Indian colony, that phrase is specific to Nevada, just like rancherias are specific to California. And they take on many of the same characteristics. Western Shoshone people did not want to leave their homelands, who were seeking wage labor jobs, often congregated on the outskirts of these towns. And they created what were known as colonies. Some of these were interethnic communities. You see here the logo of the Reno Sparks Indian Colony. The Reno Sparks Colony is a multi-ethnic colony of Paiutes, Shoshones, and Washoe people. And it sits in South Reno, south of the Truckee River, between downtown and the airport. Right? Now, many of these will gain federal recognition in the early 20th century. Right? Fallon, Reno Sparks, and Battle Mountain all became federally recognized Indian communities in 1917, Elko in 1918, and Ely in 1931. Right. The last one to get federal recognition was Wells, the Wells Shoshone colony right out here in eastern Nevada in 1977. And then, during the Indian Reorganization Act period, a number of these colonies formed IRA governments. Right? And that's what we want to get to here. And the most important of those was the Timok Bands. They're the most important because the Timok Bands of Western Shoshones, today known as the Timok Tribe of Western Shoshones, headquartered in Elko, Nevada, becomes the only political entity empowered by the Indian Claims Commission and the BIA to speak for all Western Shoshones, for the Western Shoshone identifiable group. Right? The Timok Bands emerge from an older set of considerations. There was a traditional treaty council that existed up until 1890, the time of Timok's death, but that was revived in 1912. Right? That treaty council, which was often led by members of the Timok family, not to be confused with the Timok bands, even though they take the name from the family, most of the Timok family is never involved in the government of that band, right? They're usually in the opposition to the claims. We'll get to later. In any case, they hired an attorney as early as 1932 to pursue a claim. This eight-member treaty council. Not to claim the land was lost, but to go after the government for unkept promises. And they were very clear about that. During the Indian Reorganization Act period, during the Indian New Deal, the Bureau of Indian Affairs pushed the Western Shoshones to form a new government, to form an umbrella government that would roughly cover the area of the treaty. And that's where the Timok bands come from, right? When it's initially chartered, the Timok bands only include the Elko colony. And at various times throughout its history, some groups join, some groups fall out. And the Battle Mountain colony joined, but then left after 1940, right? During much of this claims period, the Timok bands will only represent people living on the South Fork Reservation, south of Elko, Nevada. So not an all-inclusive group, right? Now, that brings us to the actual claim, because the Timok bands are going to be the political entity recognized by the Indian Claims Commission and the Bureau of Indian Affairs to speak for the Western Shoshone identifiable group. That's how it's going to be called, right? Docket 326 is the larger Shoshone claim. Subdocket 326K is the Western Shoshone claim. That's what we're going to focus on, right? And it involves, again, the so-called Western Shoshone identifiable group. Now, who represents them? Well, it's going to be Wilkinson, Cragin, and Barker. We've already talked about Ernest Wilkinson, very well-established Washington, D.C.-based claims attorney, was instrumental in the passage of the Indian Claims Commission. In 1945, that attorney that had been hired by the traditional treaty council of the Western Shoshones, he became a judge, and so he turned all of his business over to his partner, a man named Orville Wilson. Wilson decided it's best for him to partner with more powerful attorneys, so he brings in Wilkinson. He agrees to partner with Wilkinson. In planning for this claim, Wilkinson stakes out very clearly the position that Aboriginal title has been completely lost. He doesn't do this consulting with the Western Shoshones, but in a letter to Wilson, he says, quote, if we prosecute the Western Shoshone case, we should do it on the loss of immemorial possession. Remember, there's no financial incentive for saying title still exists, right? So he's going to pursue this idea. Now, the first time this idea is explained to the Western Shoshones is at a meeting at Elko in June of 1947. Wilson told the assembled Shoshones that the land was already gone, and the best they could hope for was a monetary settlement. And it's at that point that the Timok bands sign a contract with Wilson and with Wilkinson's partner, Robert W. Barker. And Barker is going to be the lead attorney through most of this period. By 1950, Wilkinson has convened a meeting of all Shoshones here in Utah, Shoshones from Utah, Nevada, Idaho, to pursue a larger Shoshone claim. The majority of the people who vote at this meeting vote for the claim to pursue it. But here's the problem. Many of the Shoshones there walk out or refuse to vote. Remember we talked about that problem that Native people faced when they, in these kind of competitive elections, that traditional way in which Native people show displeasure or rejection of an idea is to not participate. But just as in the initial passage of the Indian Reorganization Act we talked about last time, in this case, it hurts them because they refuse to participate. The few who remain vote in favor of it. And so you get an election that says, yes, let's go forward with this, when a large, large number of them, including the Timok family, who's led by Luchak Timok by this point, they refuse to vote. And so Wilkinson files the case on August 10th, 1951, 3 days before the deadline, right? August 13th, 51 was the deadline. So Ernest Wilkinson files this case, and then he leaves. Where does Ernest Wilkinson end up, Simenu? He becomes the president of Brigham Young University for the next 20 years, from 1951 to 1971. Yeah. So the case then falls to his partner, Robert W. Barker, and he becomes the lead on the Shoshone case and deals directly with the Western Shoshone case in particular. And it's there that we see this really emerging division between what Shoshone people will call the land people and the money people. And again, I don't want you to vilify one side or idealize another side. You have to think about the hard choices people make. The people who are deemed the money people most often are those who've been involved in IRA tribal governments who feel disempowered. They see the system and they say, we're never going to get the land back. The best we can do is get that money. That money is going to make a real difference in our life. Right? The land people, who will become known as the traditionals, not the traditionalists, but the traditionals, right? They always assert the treaty remains in force. The land was still theirs, and that accepting a settlement will effectively sell the land. If you really want to get rid of it, that's what's going to do it if we take this settlement. Edward McDade of the South Fork Reservation summarized his position this way in 1964. Quote, you will find that you are actually selling your Indian rights. Under this treaty, there isn't any mention of selling our lands. The land will always take care of you. For myself, no one will ever buy my Indian rights. They are sacred. But again, many Shoshones, Western Shoshones, will feel powerless here. And claims attorneys like Barker and the BIA are going to work through the so-called money people, the people in charge of tribal governments, often these small governments for the colonies, to keep the claims process moving. the leadership of the Timok bands, again, not including the Timok family itself, often supports the claim process, but at crucial times when there are different elections, different people in office, it will also reject the claims process. But summarizing, I think, very fairly, in 1977, an Interior Department attorney wrote this. He said, quote, although the Shoshone who assert that their title to the land is intact may be in the majority, it is those seeking damages who are accommodated by the structure of the Indian Claims Commission Act. Right? So what does he mean by that? Well, that's where we want to start looking at this. And, you know, you might get a little steamed at hearing about how this case actually worked out. So the case is filed. Wilkinson stepped aside. Barker's the lead attorney. And from that point to 1962, the case went through the title phase. There is never a move to assert that the Treaty of Ruby Valley was still in effect. Again, remember, that would mean no settlement. The expert witness called by the Shoshones was Omer Stewart, who was a longtime professor at the University of Colorado and worked with many Great Basin tribes. He testified, and it was his testimony that proved the exclusive use and occupancy of the Shoshone Nation more broadly. And ultimately, the Indian Claims Commission will issue its decision, its initial decision of title, in docket 326K, in October of 1962, right? And its decision is not going to be explained to most Western Shoshones until a rancorous meeting in March of 1963 in Elko. And so you might ask yourself, if there was no war of conquest, if there was no land cession, how did the Western Shoshones lose their land? Well, they lost it, the Indian Claims Commission decided, through a process of gradual encroachment. Gradual encroachment. The commission writes, by gradual encroachment by whites, settlers, and others, the acquisition, disposition, and taking of their lands by the United States for its own use and benefit, or for the use and benefit of its citizens, the way of life of the Western Shoshones was disrupted, and they were deprived of their lands. So basically, other people moved in, and you lost your land. Are there any legal, anything of legal precedents for this kind of idea? Closest thing it sounds like to me, and might sound like to you, is a idea from real estate law called adverse possession, where if you allow someone to use property for an extended period of time, they essentially establish a property right in your property, right? They're like an easement to cross your backyard to get to their property, something like that. They eventually establish that. But that's in case you say you don't say anything. Obviously, the Western Shoshones have been saying a lot for a long time. That traditional treaty council, since 1932, had been saying live up to the treaty. Right? The treaty still exists. It's still our land. So this has been going on for 30 years at least by that point that they'd had an attorney, right? Now, again, this meeting takes place in March of 1963. Barker explains this case, and this will alienate many Shoshones, even those who were involved in the claims process up to that point, including Clancy Blossom, who was the leader at Battle Mountain. But Carrie and Mary Dan, who will be important figures we'll talk about in a little bit, they were at that meeting. They were always opposed to the claims, however. Right? Okay, so questions on that. You should have questions, like, where does that come from? So, gradual encroachment. The land has been lost. So here's your problem, right? As you enter into the value liability phase, maybe I'll come back to this slide later. This is the map of federal lands in Nevada. Most of Nevada is federal land, much of it owned by the military. Once you've established the title and the title has been lost, what's the next step? What's it worth, right? And when do you determine, how do you determine what's it worth? A date of taking, right? How do you determine a gradual date of taking? How? Experts? Yeah, nope, not even experts. A joint stipulation. Robert W. Barker and the Indian Claims Commission and the Bureau of Indian Affairs got together and they jointly agreed. They jointly agreed that the Western Shoshones had lost their land on July 1st, 1872. This is an arbitrary date. It has no meaning in history. Nothing happened. You ever see those, go out in the desert and there's people plant these little posts and things, these signs that say on this date in 1909 on this site, absolutely nothing happened? Right? So there's a joke, you can get those gag plaques and put them up. That's the case here, right? This does not relate to any specific historical event. But on February 11th, 1966, the Indian Claims Commission accepts the date of taking that is jointly stipulated by the attorneys. The Western Shoshones, the Timok bands, are not consulted. This happens in Washington. Right? Now, the Californians, remember the Shoshone claim is about 2 million acres of it. Most of the vast majority of it is Nevada, but there's 2 million acres or so down in California. That does have a specific date related to a California law of 1852 that dictated that Indians had to make claims to the state of the property they owned. And, of course, Indians never heard about this law, but it's passed in 1852, and it goes into effect on a particular day, and that is March 3rd, 1853. So California lands are going to be valued even earlier, that smaller portion in California. Right. And so now, how do you get, you know, how do you value this land? Well, Barker needs to get money to hire professional appraisers. So he explains this to the people. There is a great deal of unrest, a great deal of unhappiness with this idea, right? And he presses ahead with the claim. In 1965, he asked the Timok Band to take out a loan on the final settlement. He goes to the Timok Band and says, take out a loan on the final settlement, then we can hire appraisers. They will go out and determine what it's worth. Timok Band says, nope, we're not going to do that. At this point, they reject it. So what Barker does is call four meetings, along with BIA officials, across Nevada, in Austin and Elko and a couple other places, I think Ely. So the Western Shoshones get together. The same kind of thing happens, it always happens. The people who are opposed to it walk out. Right? They don't like the process, they're upset with it, they express their displeasure, and they walk out, they don't vote. The majority who are there, who remain, vote to approve the loan. Right? And so in order to handle the claims process, though, since the Timok bands didn't take out the loan and the Western Shoshone identifiable groups taking out the loan, the Bureau of Indian Affairs establishes a Western Shoshone Claims Committee. This will be a group of individual Western Shoshones who are empowered to pursue the claim and to make decisions. It would operate from 1965 to 1980. One of the original members of the Claims Commission was Raymond Yowell. He becomes one of the principal opponents of the claim down the road, right? But he's one of the original members. And so it's with that $145,000 loan that the appraisers go out and they come up with a figure. And that figure will be accepted by the Indian Claims Commission on October 11, 1972. The Claims Commission will accept the appraisal for 22 million acres of Nevada land at $21,350,000, about 96 cents an acre. And for the 2 million acres plus in California, $200,000, about 9 cents an acre. Remember, we're appraising Death Valley in 1853. Remember, no interest, right? There is, however, going to be an additional $4 million added for mining profits that were lost in Western Shoshone country before the date of taking. So any mining profits before July 1, 1872. The total award then, $26,154,000 for 24,396,000 acres, about $1.07 an acre. Pretty good deal if you can get it. So this is where it sits in 1972. The claim has gone through the initial title phase, it's gone through the value liability phase, and now it's supposed to be a done deal. But this is where things are going to go off the rail. It's going to take 40 more years for the settlement to actually reach Shoshone people. 40 more years. Okay. Let's see where we're at here. Now, resistance to the claim had existed going pretty far back, right? I talked about the Dans earlier in that 1963 meeting. The Dan family had opposed this from the very beginning. But other Shoshones are also opposed to this. Right? In 1973, after the evaluation, after the value liability phase, there's another contentious meeting in Elko, and a BIA official actually looks at the Shoshones and he says that the treaty gave the Shoshones no land, and he said, quote, according to the treaty, you lost everything. I don't think that's a very weird reading of the treaty, right? Because there is absolutely no land cession. It says nothing about losing anything in the treaty, but this is a BIA official saying this. This, of course, as you can imagine, irritates a lot of people. Once again, they walk out. But in this case, there's a filmmaker there, Joel Friedman, who will make the first of two movies titled Broken Treaty at Battle Mountain. And this is one of those movies that Robert Redford narrates, and comes out in 1975. Now, the grassroots resistance to this, to the claim, is going to take the form of individuals and groups who want to, again, assert the right of a traditional Shoshone form of leadership and ownership of the land, and that the treaty has never led to any loss of land. These so-called traditionals. One of them is this guy right here, Glenn Hawley, and he's the founder of the Western Shoshone Legal Defense and Education Association, which later takes the name the Western Shoshone Sacred Lands Association. Right, you can see some of the other members of that association in 1979, most famously the Dan sisters, Mary Dan and Carrie Dan right there. Right. So these folks are going to, again, recognize a traditional form of Shoshone leadership. They recognize Frank Timok, who had proclaimed a Western Shoshone nation in 1965 as a traditional chief. And in 1974, they are going to bring a motion before the Indian Claims Commission for a stay, basically saying the groups that have spoke for us do not speak for all Western Shoshones. They also argued that there was a great deal of collusion between the law firm and the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Indian Claims Commission. Therefore, the settlement needed to be put on hold, right? The Indian Claims Commission rejected the petition. In its decision, it said it amounted to a request for a rehearing. It said if you wanted a rehearing, you needed to make that within 30 days of the 1962 decision. Right, so there's a technicality there. It rejected out of hand the petitioner's claims of collusion. And further, the Indian Claims Commission stated it would not have approved the 1872 date of taking for the lands had it been, quote, unfair to the petitioners, unquote. Right. So they're completely shut down. Now, the interesting thing is that by 1976, the Timok bands have changed hands in leadership. And the traditionals are in charge of the Timok bands. They issue two tribal resolutions. One to make a stay of this settlement, saying let's stop this right now. And the other, you're going to love this one, they want to fire their attorney. They want to fire Robert W. Barker. In both cases, the Indian Claims Commission rejects their attempt. They can't even fire, they're not allowed to fire their own attorney. Right. Barker, for his part, responds that his contract was with the Claims Committee, not with the Timok bands, which is an apparent contradiction of the ICC's finding that only the Timok bands officially speak for the claimants, right? In any case, that's the way it goes down. One council member of the Timok band said, quote, we had no choice between taking money or trying to get the land back. Mr. Barker made the choice and told the commission that we had no title and our treaty was no good, unquote. Right. So Barker will remain in charge of this claim until the final, until the payment of money. All right. So again, we've got this grassroots resistance that's focused on traditional leadership, but we've also got the Indian Claims Commission accepting a very strict definition of how this is going to play out that definitely favors the claims attorneys, who by this point are really driving the issue. In 1977, the ICC issued its final decision. In the Western Shoshone case, it accepted it all. The Court of Claims on Appeal upholds the award of $26 million in 1979. And it's at that point that a special account was created. That $26 million is deposited in that special account. And Wilkinson, Cragen, and Barker receive their $2.6 million. Right. So they get paid. And it's at that point that, of course, Barker is no longer the attorney because, you know, the case is, according to the ICC, to the Court of Claims, over. But it's not close to over, right? In 1980, the majority of Shoshones who do attend the meeting voice their displeasure. They reject the settlement money, right? So by the 1980s, this is really changing. Now, we also see a move to try to establish a more formal treaty council that reflects a traditional form of government. And that's going to become known as the Western Shoshone National Council. Right. It's going to be officially formed in January 1984 as a potential entity to speak for all Western Shoshones. Five groups form the initial council, and within 4 years it expands to 18 groups, including the Timok bands and many of the other Indian Reorganization Act governments. But it never becomes a federally recognized group. The leader who steps forward is acknowledged as a traditional chief of this council is Raymond Yowell. Remember, he was one of the first members of the Claims Commission, or the Western Shoshone Claims Committee that was established in 65. When he publicly broke with Barker in 1977, and he said, quote, "For over 20 years, Mr. Barker has been the cause of much fighting between ourselves and has done nothing to preserve or enforce our rights except try to give up our rights for money so he can get his 10%. Right, so that's Raymond Yowell's take on it. He becomes the leader of this group. Again, this council is never federally recognized, nor does it seek federal recognition. It seeks to operate as a traditional form of council in which all Western Shoshones discuss an issue at hand and come to a conclusion. It is going to be treated as a government, though, in a couple of cases in the late 80s and the early 90s, especially when the federal court in Nevada recognizes the right of the council to manage Shoshone hunting and fishing in response to a lawsuit against the Nevada Department of Wildlife. But overall, it never becomes a federally recognized entity. Right? But it still is one of those groups that is out there still fighting against the claim. Now, it's at this point also, a little bit earlier, in the early 1970s, that Cary and Mary Dann emerged really as the public face of the resistance to the claim and also to traditional land use. And they live on a ranch in northern Nevada in Crescent Valley. They have a small ranch that their father had purchased in the 1930s. So they have this little chunk of land, and they traditionally run cattle and horses on the open range around them. Right. This land, of course, came under the jurisdiction of the Bureau of Land Management, even earlier under the Taylor Grazing Act, but they didn't pay grazing fees. Their argument was, this is Western Shoshone land, we've always used this land, and it has not been lost, it hasn't been alienated. So they've been vocal opponents of the claim going way back. In 1973, after the valuation was considered, the BLM would issue its first unauthorized trespass notice to the Danns. And the following year, the sisters sue the government. And the case of U.S. v. Mary and Cary Dann is going to be in the courts for about 17 years. It's going to go through numerous incarnations, go all the way to the Supreme Court and back. At one level, the first time a district court decides, it said, well, you lost all the land in 1872, because that's according to the Indian Claims Commission. But this is reversed by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Another federal court decided that the creation of a special account, remember in 1979, the money's paid in the special account, that's when you lost your land, right? It eventually goes all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court says, well, that's not really true, but there might be individual aboriginal rights. And it remanded it back down the line for decision, right? And eventually, though, just to cut a long story short, because we're getting kind of close on time, what happens is by 1989, courts kind of recognized this idea of individual aboriginal rights based on the Dan sister's father, Dewey, his previous grazing permits. But they leave the process. They say, you know what, we don't want individual aboriginal rights. We want to affirm the right of Western Shoshone people to use the land as they always had. Right? And it's after that, in the early 1990s, that raids against the Dan sisters really increase. In February 1992, the BLM moved to round up the Dan horses, but Carrie Dan stopped that roundup by getting in the middle of the cattle pen with the cattle. And the BLM was afraid she'd be crushed to death, so they backed off and left. Right? The wind is picking up. And so this continues, though, throughout the 1990s. Sporadic raids, big raids in 2002. Raids that included on not just the Dans, but the herds of Raymond Yowell, chief of the Western Shoshone National Council. And a major raid takes place in September of 2002 using helicopters and a spotter plane, semis and horse trailers. 232 head of cattle are taken, and they're sold at auction in Reno on October 4th, 2002. One of the buyers, though, supports the Dans, and he bought three of their bulls and returned them to the sisters as a statement that he agreed with their position. This may sound, of course, very, very reminiscent of a recent case in southern Nevada, which, though, has some very fundamental differences. We can talk about that later if there's any time. Now, the Dan sisters and others in this traditional movement will also find common cause with the environmental and the anti-nuclear movement, right? Because much of the Western Shoshone landscape, much of the Western Shoshone claim, is some of the most militarized land in the United States. Even though the land was supposedly taken in 1872, not that many people were ever there, right? Besides Shoshones. Today, the population of Nevada is just about 3 million, and over 90% lives in two places. Right? About 25% lives in the Reno, Carson City, Sparks area, just down from Lake Tahoe, and almost 70% lives in metropolitan Las Vegas. Both of those areas, by the way, are outside of the Western Shoshone claim. Las Vegas is southern Paiute country, and Reno is Washoe and northern Paiute country. Some of the least densely populated counties in the United States, Esmeralda County, within the Shoshone claim, has 0.27 persons per square mile. 0.27 persons. The density of Salt Lake City is about almost 1,700 persons per square mile. Gives you an idea. So this is not a country that is really being occupied. It is occupied by the federal government, though. The most famous portion of land, of course, being the Nevada test site, where over 900 bombs were set off over several decades. Atmospheric testing, you know, ended over 50 years ago, but hundreds of bombs were tested underground. So this is Yucca Flat, right, northwest of Las Vegas, and every one of those craters is a subsidence crater from a nuclear explosion, right? And so protesting the Nevada test site, protesting the taking of Western Shoshone lands for this also brings the Dan sisters and the other traditionals together with the anti-nuclear movement, with the environmental movement. In 1979, the government rolls out an idea for this MX missile. Right? It's going to be put on racetracks and hidden in the desert of eastern Nevada and western Utah. So the Western Shoshones oppose that. So does, however, a lot of people in Utah. So that one gets... that one gets derailed. And, of course, very controversially within Western Shoshone country is Yucca Mountain, which is supposed to be the site of the permanent high-level nuclear waste storage facility. Other environmental issues, just to give you an idea here, how much land we're talking about here, right? This is the Western Shoshone country, but if you look at the Nevada test site alone, right, we're talking about land that is... 4,500 square miles between the test site and the Nellis Air Force Range around it. 4,500 square miles. It's larger than the state of Connecticut. Now, also, there's a new gold rush to Nevada, right? And this also brings other environmental concerns, certainly right around where the Dan sisters live in Crescent Valley. In 2008, Kerry Dan became a party to a lawsuit against the Canadian mining company Barrick Gold, an attempt to stop the expansion of the massive Cortez open pit mine. Right? So that's where all of the money in Nevada comes from today. Nevada is the largest gold producing state in the United States, and 80% of the gold the United States produces comes from Nevada, and the United States ranks third in the world in gold production today. So that's a lot of money moving through those areas. And they use what is known as cyanide heap leach mining. So they use a cyanide-based solution to remove gold from the tailings. Okay. Now, are there other ways to deal with this, right? So we've got the traditionals opposing taking the money. This is being held up for decades at this point. One bright thing that comes out of this is the recognition not just of the Timbisha Shoshone people in Death Valley, but the negotiated settlement that takes place there, right? This is one positive outcome of this. The Timbisha Shoshones had lived in and around Death Valley for thousands of years. They refused to leave Death Valley after the monument was formed in 1933 and the park in 1994. Tribal members charged that the National Park Service employees would destroy their homes when they left the valley for the mountains in the summer. But as part of the California Desert Protection Act of 1994, the National Park Service was mandated to go into a series of negotiations with the Shoshone people to come up with reservation lands both inside and around the expanded Death Valley National Park. Right? And the outcome was a multi-parcel reservation of 7,600 acres in locations outside the park and a 314-acre reservation at Furnace Creek in the very heart of the park. And I took that picture a couple years ago. It's just south of Furnace Creek, the headquarters of the park and the main visitor center. There is this Shoshone reservation recognized within the national park. Charles Wilkinson, the famous Indian rights attorney, who one of the founders of NARF at the University of Colorado, he suggested this settlement would offer a model for a negotiated settlement. He argued that this was a model that could be used and that decent-sized reservations should be the answer, right? That a series of negotiations should take place and multiple Shoshone reservations should be created across Nevada throughout the claims area, right? And that land should be guaranteed in time, in perpetuity. But that's not the way it works out. Right? By the late 1990s, most of the tribal councils had moved towards accepting the claim. Right? This is a long process. In 1997, the Timok Council again issued a resolution that it was in favor of accepting the claim and did this again in 2002. Duckwater and Ely Shoshone supported the resolution. Fort McDermott, Fallon, Duck Valley. The only group to consistently oppose it by the late 1990s and early 2000s was the Yamba Shoshone in south central Nevada. And it's at this point that Harry Reid will introduce a bill into Congress, and Congress will pass, and George W. Bush will sign into law the Western Shoshone Claims Distribution Act. The act provides for the per capita, 100% per capita, distribution of the original award with interest and the use of a smaller award for an educational trust fund. To get the land or to get the money, right, the BIA must create an eligibility rule. And this is going to sound familiar to you as we talked about Dawes rolls and race and blood quantum and how that all comes into play in the 20th century. You have to prove, quote, 1/4 degree of Western Shoshone blood to be eligible for a payment. Creating the roll would take years. It's passed in 2004, but the final roll, the final deadline to apply is not until August 2, 2010. Eventually, 9,600 people apply, and the final roll includes 5,631 persons. Right? Many people who oppose the claim still signed up because they said you'd have to be foolish not to, because if you don't, you won't get anything, and the land will be lost, right? And so beginning in 2011, the first partial payments went out. And then in September 2012, about 2.5 years ago, the final payments went out. And each individual who was eligible received $35,137.93. The total payout was about $188 million because of the interest since the time of the special account was created. Right? And so this officially ended the Western Shoshone land claim. There are still people who oppose the claim. Obviously, there are still people who say this is unjust. There are still people who argue, even if this claim has been accepted, we still need to pursue the return of land, and that should be just. Right? I mean, when you think about this, what had happened, right, that this had taken 60 years. Right? 1951, it had taken 61 years since the case had been filed. Right? It had taken 50 years since the finding of gradual encroachment, right? And 46 years since the stipulation of 1872 as a taking date, right? And 40 years since the value was accepted, right? And over 35 years since the claim was upheld and had been fought this entire time. Right? And so what does this all mean? Well, it means, obviously, that for tribal sovereignty to exist, a land base and control over resources is essential. But not all people have that ability. It also points to, I think, the real deep divisions between traditional forms of government and property ownership and those of Euro-American conceptions that are really dominant in the legislation and in these kinds of systems, and is one of the ways in which we can see some of the limitations that are placed on Native communities today and some of the hard choices they make. And people who take the claim are not necessarily, they're not selling out, right? It's maybe the best deal they will get. And so they make hard choices. So any questions on all of this? Or are you just stunned? You're a very quiet group today. All right, well, I guess I will see you next time.
American History TV continues all this week with programs and events in prime time. On Tuesday, a look at African American